Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as you know, we're going through the notes on nullification with Paul, and Paul is back. And welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
When we were ending yesterday's show, we started talking about the uniformity clause at the very end of paragraph 58. And so, you know, because paragraph 58 basically says, you know, I'll just read the whole thing because it's short. It appears that the object to be attained by the invited cooperation with Virginia was, as expressed in the 3rd and 7th resolution, to maintain within the several states their respective authorities, rights, and liberties, which could not be constitutionally different in different states, mm-hmm. nor inconsistent with the sameness and authority and laws of the United States in all and in each. I've said this and I've said this. The whole point of that uniformity clause, when you go through the definitions, this literally lays out that the United States or the federal government cannot treat one state different than another state. It can't create favor or it can't punish one state. It has to do everything equally all the time. I mean, it's almost like the Constitution forces fair parenting. Mm-hmm. I mean, or I should say, because it actually, that concept really perverts the whole relationship because the states are the parents.
Right.
In other words, it forces the child's behavior to equally respond and equally, you know, be attentive to the parents. Period.
Correct.
And so the whole point, and as I was going down this path, you know, there was this huge advantage in bringing states into the union. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I was saying going out, and this is in the Why Counties Matter Most article that's almost done. When we look at a new state coming into the union as a territory, it is not subject to the apportionment tax.
Right.
The only state, because you don't get taxed by the principles of the Constitution and our framework. You know, I go back to, and just to be clear, we've got this really good interview coming up with Michael McKibbins, and there's all of this evidence, there's all this evidence that England, Britain, had been in our britches from the very beginning, you know, of the foundation of this, you know, from the colonies through the revolution and the evolution of our government. They've been in our britches, but the design of the Constitution actually kept them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as we look at this, the growth of the Union and new states joining the Union, just like the principle of the colonies, because the colonies were not states in Britain, they were just colonies. And the fact that Britain was taxing them is a completely, in other words, the colonies were a subject to Britain.
Okay.
And when we created this new government, it was reverse. In other words, the states could not be the subject. The subject mm-hmm. was the federal government.
Right.
And the states only became a subject in a very specific way when they became a state, and that was on the form of taxation, the constitutional limitations of taxation. So when a new state, when a new territory joins the union, it all of a sudden gets its apportionment and its representation. You know that cry, taxation without representation. There right. you go. Territories were not apportioned for taxation because they didn't have representation. Now, one of the interesting things is Congress did make an allowance to allow them to participate, but they weren't true voting members. So, in other words, the territories actually had, you know, somebody that was in Congress to communicate this is what's going on because, you know, the fact of them getting ready to become a state was in their interest to hear what Congress was saying. So they actually had witnesses on the ground or witnesses mm-hmm. in the chambers so they could hear. So they were kind of treated like an equal congressman, but they couldn't, right. but they
Except
couldn't
they didn't
vote. So the whole point of representation really came down to suffrage.
Okay.
So, in other words, you may have, you know, the chamber access and all of that. If you don't have suffrage in the process, you don't have representation. It's just a courtesy type of thing. Mm-hmm. So, as new states, again, join the union, then all of a sudden the revenue, because the burden of the union reduced. Every time a new state joined the union, the burden of the union reduced because now the taxation was spread further. So sure. it was in the interest of the union to, you know, rapidly bring states in. And so as they were basically trying to break, you know, or bring states in at a breakneck speed. Mm-hmm. I think that there were some circumstances like Wyoming, it didn't fully, you know, meet the parameters of, you know, of 60,000 citizens in the state. So Wyoming just kind of, you know, rushed things along and pushed the issue. And they said, we're a state now. And here's our constitution. Here's our government. And the federal government just scratched their head to go, okay, whatever. You know, now we can tax you.
Right.
But one of the things.
So there was an incentive.
Yeah. There was. But as they started moving, and this is why I bring this up. In this document, in this, you know, article, Why Counties Matter Most, I provide you, listeners, everybody that reads this, I provide you a comparison and contrasting to the very first enabling act of bringing Vermont into the union. And then I think it was maybe the 10th state or whatever Indiana was, because Indiana came in 1916. Into the union. And it was in Indiana where the federal government actually started playing games with, but they were making assertions and they were doing things that they had no authority to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Congress doing all of this. And so I kind of highlight everything with red. You know, within the Enabling Act, this right here was a violation. There may be some parts of it that were problematic, but they were actually making assertions or telling this new sovereign state. See, folks, we went through this when we went through the Constitution. When you read Article 4, Section 3, the responsibility is laid out in the first paragraph of Section 3. The second paragraph of Section 3 are those things that the Congress had, you know, this is how Congress is going to fulfill that responsibility. And so inside that second paragraph is the Congress can make the needful rules and regulations regarding the territory. They cannot make any rules or regulations in the actual forming and the admission of the state as far as determining its, you know, its labor, whether it's going to be a slave state or a free state. They can't, yeah. they can't basically say, nor do they have the power to keep any land that when a state joins the union to say that we're going to keep this land for this reason. If they're going to keep land within a state, any state, whether it be a forest, a national park, or what have you, and this is why I want to do this spreadsheet so that I can lay out, you know, if we're going to have uniformity, then all of the other states have to give up this percentage of their land. If we're going to have uniformity.
Well, that would get their attention. You
and all the other states would give up all, you know, would take back all of their land to get back to that percentage. right? I mean, so, and you know what? I'm going to tell you something. When you really look at Alaska, I mean, Alaska is almost all federal.
And Nevada is almost all federal.
Nevada is as well. Yeah, so when you get these really high numbers, it helps skew the average. We may have 30%. Who knows? Wow. I need to look at, and you were supposed to send me that, so don't forget
this. You're speaking of Washington, right?
What's that?
You were speaking of Washington State, have only 30%.
No. I'm saying all of the different states. All states in the union, maybe the average state that the federal government should take back. But the only way they can actually possess land is enumerated. In other words, for magazines, forts, shipyards, something like that, you know, dockyards or whatever, and needful buildings. They don't have anything enumerated for them to possess land for, you know, forestry purposes or for conservation or for, let me see here. What was the other one? Environmental, you know, all of these different things that they're grabbing your land for. Mm-hmm. They, if it's not enumerated, then they can't do it. So they can't even possess this land. That's the whole point. But bottom line, I want to really start putting a real spotlight, because when you look through the Enabling Acts, this is where they really started playing the shenanigans of taking and taking and taking. And so what that did was it created an unfair burden on Indiana compared to every other state in the union.
Right.
Because all of a sudden it had these resources that the federal government says, these salt mines, you know, you can't use or you can't sell. You have to, you know, you can lease them, but that's all you can do. And, you know, where do they get off? Where do they have the authority to tell a state that they can't do those things?
Well, they don't.
They don't. Right. So anyway, getting into and looking at this uniformity. So this is the last thing I really want to make a point on, because this really came to me and it hit me, because I talk about this union being like a marriage, right? Where you have 50 parents and one child.
Mm-hmm.
Single state nullification creates a complete perversion to the relationship of the union, because the relationship of the union is 50 to 50, 50 states to 50 states. In other words, one to 49, you know, in other words,
okay.
The true relationship is 50 to 50 and 50 to one, or I should say 1 to 49 and 50 to one. That's the relationship. In other words, all of the parents are 1 to 1 in relationship to each other. And then when it comes to the relationship of the state, it is the relationship of the states to the child. So it is 50 to 1. But what ends up happening when you actually go down the path of single state nullification, you pervert that relationship to 1 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. In fact, that makes it a lot more clear.
Yes. Right. Because the union means that all states joined in saying we are going to be, you know, they're not supposed to be submitting to tyranny. It is their job. This is the whole point of these resolutions and the interposition. It's their job to interpose every time the child steps out of bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so what more can I say? Anyway, so I think that there's no more mud left for the dead horse.
Okay.
And so I don't know if there's anything else to kind of cover to answer in this discussion regarding single state and paragraphs down to 64. So I think we can start moving forward from 65, unless you've got another question.
No, I don't think I have any other questions. So we're going to start at 65.
At 65, yeah.
Okay. You ready?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. It has been sufficiently shown from the language of the report, as has been seen, that the right in the states to interpose declarations and protests against unconstitutional acts of Congress had been denied and that the reasoning in the resolutions was called for by that denial, into the triumphant tone with which it is affirmed and reiterated, that the resolutions must have been directed against what no one denied, unless they were meant to assert the right of a single state to arrest and annul acts of the federal legislature, makes it proper to adduce that a proof of the fact that the declaratory right was denied, which, if it does not silence the advocate of nullification, must render every candid ear indignant at the repetition of the untruth. Okay, GR, here's another one of these paragraphs, and this is one that you would need a dictionary with, because I've been introduced to a couple of new words. One of them is adduce. All right? But he is, he and his readers would understand this paragraph. It would take me about three readings to get it right. And so we've got another one here that we need some help with.
Okay, so adduce is basically like to offer, present, to give, to, you know, to give that proof of the fact that the declaration or the declaratory right was denied. So anyway.
So here's the question I have. So, okay. The right of the states to interpose declarations and protests against unconstitutional had been denied. What is he talking about? Okay, because it because this is what he and Jefferson did.
Right.
So what is the denial he's referring to? In other words, okay, the Alien and Sedition Acts were proposed and passed and signed. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Virginia and Kentucky presented resolutions.
Yes.
Where is the denial he's referring to?
The other states. The other states denied their responsibility.
Oh, okay. That's what I wanted to clarify. It wasn't that the federal government denied. It's that the other states pushed back and denied.
Yes.
That they had the responsibility to join with Virginia and Kentucky.
In other words, they were allowing the perversion of the Constitution. See, okay. you have this, I'll just say, these directions, right? You know, kind of have these, you know, let's just say you got a football player on a vibrating field. And so if you bend those things, they'll go a certain direction. There's little fingers underneath the football player. And most people don't even understand this because they never played football on a vibrating field. You know, that little game. I don't know if you've ever played that game. The field would vibrate. And the
Yes. But you know how old I was when I played? I had a friend that had one of those games, and I was probably 9 or 10.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, really old. It was weak because it was never really a test of skills. It was just, accidents of vibration in science, right? Anyway, as you kind of point one direction. So you got this energy that kind of is to move you one way or the other. And when we look at the 50 states, when you have a couple of states within the union and you can't get the union to move, when they're responsible, when their obligation is to go in the other direction, what it does is it creates a shift where the federal government feels enabled. It's like a child being enabled to do bad behavior. They're going to do more. They're going to do more. This is why Jefferson was so, I refer to some of his language as hyperbolic, because he was really, you know, going, this is it. This is the end. We cannot allow this to happen. But, you know, it was the first step towards the end, to be truthful.
Okay.
In other words, it was opening the door for the floodgates of the federal government to get out from this constrainment under this Constitution. And that's why he said, we can't allow this to happen. Mm-hmm. And so, to be very, very clear, when you really look at what was happening, and as Madison laid out this conspiracy of how the federal government was moving down this path of, you know, basically fall, you know, working its way to fall underneath Britain again, or to be formed in a similar mode and possibly to become a commonwealth or what have you, but still to move back towards a monarchy or a, because that's what Madison said in that letter to John G. Jackson. Remember, the predilections of either a monarchy or an aristocracy. He said, mm-hmm. you know, there was this secret movement. And so Hamilton was the chief designer of this.
Right.
And so we're looking at 1798, and we're already seeing Hamilton had already created this wrong violation. And, you know, come to find out, the four banks that he created were actually, you know, underwritten. They were backed by foreign interests.
Wow.
And that was all unconstitutional. They don't have any authority to allow foreign interest to have any control. And so this is why, this is what caused Jefferson and Madison in 1792, when those banks were, when the first bank was created, they said, this is an abomination. We got to create a party. And Hamilton was basically already prepared with an onslaught of attacks. Wow. So it was really hard for Jefferson and Madison to, you know, kind of pull the reins back. But I believe the cod fishery bounties, that was in 1792 as well. We read those. Mm-hmm. And there were other little things. The whiskey rebellion was another thing. You got to understand that they had to process stuff serially. They didn't right. have the ability to do a lot of parallel processing.
Correct.
And so, you know, it was this one issue that became overwhelming. I mean, they did a little bit of multitasking, but they didn't have, you know, this huge apparatus that they created today, to where, you know, you can actually see, excuse me, you can actually see how the monster and all of its tentacles are operating almost independently and attacking us. From spraying in the skies to taking our property and selling it and undermining us regarding our property rights and, you know, basically subsidizing, you know, the production of food and moving us towards a dependency. I mean, all of these different things are happening concurrently and autonomously almost.
Right.
So anyway, I digress. But the point is what we're looking at. And what he's talking about is that the federal government, they couldn't deny it. The denial had to come from the union itself. In other words, the union denied doing what it did, what it was supposed to do, what they were obligated to do. And what ended up happening was it enabled bad behavior by the federal government. And it was such a, you know, this was such a big deal to Jefferson and Madison. They said, we're not going to take this, even though they're not going to, you know, do something about it. We're going to run a campaign and we're going to unseat these guys. And they they reached back, grabbed the Republican Party and started moving forward.
Right.
Right.
Okay. That clarifies.
So the next one, the proof is found.
The proof is found in the recorded votes of a large and respectable portion of the House of Delegates at the time of passing the report.
He's talking about the Virginia legislature.
Oh, okay. A motion, see the journal, offered at the closing scene affirms, quote, that protests made by the legislature of this or any other state against particular acts of Congress as unconstitutional, accompanied with invitations to other states to join in such protests, are improper and unauthorized assumption of power.
Okay. Hold on, Paul. We're going to have to take you into a break here. And so, folks, as we kind of move forward here, we'll pick this up from the beginning of the paragraph. I'll have Paul pick this up at the beginning of the paragraph. So that way it'll all make sense because he really didn't get into the meat. So we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
What
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so apparently, you know, folks, Paul really can't hear the music, and sometimes he just, in defense of Paul, he just, you know, he's reading, and so you don't, you're not looking at all this other stuff. So, anyway, thank heavens I have a little bit of a mixer so I could actually mute Paul manually, but I couldn't get to it fast enough because I didn't have it up.
Well, sir, yeah, I was getting into the paragraph.
It's okay. So let's start off at the top of that. A motion, see the journal. Go ahead.
Right. A motion, see the journal, offered at the closing scene affirms, quote, that protests made by the legislature of this or any other state against particular acts of Congress as unconstitutional, accompanied with invitations to other states to join in such protests, are improper and unauthorized assumptions of power not permitted nor intended to be permitted to the state legislatures. And inasmuch as correspondent sentiments with the present have been expressed by those of our sister states who have acted on the resolutions of 1798 resolved, therefore, that the present General Assembly, convinced of the impropriety of the resolutions of the last Assembly, deem it expedient further to act on the said resolutions, end quote. G.R.
Yes.
Who said this? Who is he quoting?
This quote is out of the journal. This is out of the Virginia resolutions, the journal that, you know, when they were getting ready to sign off. That's what he's saying here. A motion offered at the closing scene affirms. This is what they said. Quote, and then to close quote. So, in other words, they're basically saying that, you know, we're signing off on this and that, you know, that we need to do this because they were convinced of the impropriety. The General Assembly, convinced of the impropriety of the resolutions of the last Assembly, deem it inexpedient further to act on the said resolutions. So I don't, you know, actually,
maybe I'm reading it backward.
Okay. Possibly, but bottom line, you got to remember that not one other state after Virginia basically supported the Kentucky resolutions, not one other state actually came back to say, we agree, we're responding in kind. They didn't do that. They turned their backs on it. So I don't know if this is actually the Virginia resolutions, because he really doesn't say.
It must be another state. Well, let's look at what it says.
Yeah.
Here's what it says. It says, he says that the protests made by the legislature of this or any other state regarding acts of Congress as unconstitutional, accompanied with invitations of the other states to join in such protests, are improper and unauthorized assumptions of power not permitted.
Yeah.
Power by the states? It sounds like it's saying that the states got no business doing this.
Yeah, so that was, I believe, possibly, maybe South Carolina. I don't know. But you're right. I think this was another state. It wasn't Virginia.
Yeah, he's not telling us what state it is.
Yeah, correct. But moving into 67, keep going. Let's keep going. On this resolution,
That is what I read.
No. So our numbers are messed up, and I don't know what your number is. All right, the next paragraph.
So this resolution, the votes, according to the yeas and nays, were 57 of the former and 98 of the latter. Okay. So it seems like this may have been Virginia, but that resolution failed.
Keep moving.
Okay. 69. Here then, within the House of Delegates itself, more than one-third of the whole number denied the right of the state legislatures to proceed by declaratory acts merely against the constitutionality of acts of Congress, and affirmed, moreover, that the states who had acted on the resolutions of Virginia entertained the same sentiments.
Okay. So he's basically saying that this is what he was getting from other states. Still doesn't identify what state asserted that, but keep going.
Okay. With this testimony under the eye, it may surely be expected that it will never again be said that such a right had never been denied, nor the pretext again resorted to that which, without such a denial, the nullifying doctrine alone could satisfy the true meaning of the legislature. See the instructions to the members of Congress passed at the same session, which do not squint at the nullifying idea. See also the protest of the minority in the Virginia legislature and the report of the Committee of Congress on the Proceedings of Virginia to be examined for the journals. It has been asked whether every right has not its remedy and what other remedy exists under the government of the United States against usurpations of power but a right in the states individually to annul and resist them.
So obviously this is a state that has gone down this path of single state nullification, but a right in the states individually. So in other words, this is what they're using as a justification.
Right.
Keep going.
Okay. The plain answer is that the remedy is the same under the government of the U.S. as under all other governments established and organized on free principles. The first remedy is in the checks provided among the constituted authorities. That failing, the next is in the influence of the ballot boxes. And hustings? That again failing, the appeal lies to the power that made the Constitution and can explain, amend, or remake it. What are hustings?
Well, I mean, I'd have to look it up, but I would think that hustings or ballot boxes and hustings, I have no idea.
Anyway. I didn't mean to throw that at you. It was just hustings, definition, really quick. A meeting at which candidates in an election address potential voters.
That's
a new word. I'd never heard it before. Okay?
Uh-huh.
All right. So we are now on 74, or did I finish?
No, 74? No, you didn't finish it. So just go beyond that.
Should this resort also fail and the power usurped be sustained in its oppressive exercise in a minority by a majority, the final course to be pursued by the minority must be a subject of calculation in which the degree of oppression, the means of resistance, the consequences of its failure, and the consequences of success must be the elements.
Keep going.
Does not this view of the case equally belong to every one of the states of Virginia, for example? 75. Should the constituted authorities of the state unite in usurping oppressive powers, should the constituent body fail to arrest the progress of the evil through the elective process according to the forms of the Constitution, and should the authority which is above that of the Constitution, the majority of the people, inflexibly support the oppression inflicted on of the minority, nothing would remain for the minority but to rally to its reserved rights, for every citizen has his reserved rights, as exemplified in declarations prefixed to most of the state constitutions, and to decide between acquiescence and resistance, according to the calculation above stated.
Yeah, so he's basically kind of going through the scenario of, you know, if if you don't succeed, then what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't point out, at least he hasn't pointed out, that in that scenario, they didn't go down to a individual citizen. It became a battle cry for these two men who carried such credentials that they could actually carry the states, you know, down a, if you want to call it a revolutionary path, but it wasn't a revolution of arms. It was a revolution of the ballots in voting out these tyrants.
Essentially, they succeeded. It may not have been as spectacular as all the states supporting them, but apparently they did it in a timely enough manner that they succeeded at the ballot box.
Yes, and so I've said this before. We're actually in a part of this document where Madison goes into analysis in looking at, you know, nullification from the framers' perspective and, you know, what else is there to do, because they still don't understand interposition. But bottom line, you know, this is a very confusing part of the notes because he goes down this analysis and people, you know, get confused. Is he supporting nullification or is he against it? What he's doing is he's really analyzing and... to be honest, you know, you really have to actually know exactly what he's talking about when it comes to, you know, these quotations, what state is this, and so forth. Like, the, you know, the questions that we've come up with. But anyway, next one. Go ahead.
Okay. Those who question the analogy of this respect between the two cases, however different they may be in some other respects, must say, as some of them, with a boldness truly astonishing, do say that the Constitution of the U.S., which as such and under that name was presented to and accepted by those who ratified it, which has been so deemed and so called by those living under it for nearly half a century, and as such sworn to by every officer, state as well as federal, as yet no constitution but a treaty, a league, or at most a confederacy among nations, as independent and sovereign in relation to each other as before the charter which calls itself a constitution was formed. Okay, GR, translation, please.
So basically, he kind of went through the analogy, like he's just saying, and regardless of the respects, he's basically pointing down to, you know, this constitution that was ratified by all of these states. In other words, all of these states willingly formed a union. All of these states willingly formed a one to the whole. Remember, we talked about this, and I, you know, started this off, that when a state joins the union, it creates a one to the many. In other words, 1 to 49. You know, us with all the other states in the union with this equal, you know, it's us to the union. It's not us to one and us to the other and us, you know, it's not 1 to 1. And go ahead.
I want to point out something else in this last line that stood out for me. I have said this to my audience, and you've probably said this as well, but it's yet no constitution but a treaty, a league, or at most a confederacy among nations as independent and sovereign.
Right.
So when they used the term state, they didn't mean a subject. They meant a sovereign
entity. A sovereign state, yes.
Like a nation.
Correct.
Correct. And I am glad to have seen him put these – I'm going to highlight this because he made these words very specific and really described what we are.
Right. So when you look at the states, the way we form states, we actually made a big mistake by forming the states and not forming the counties first. You know, during the Federalist Papers, you probably remember the constant reminder of, you know, republics function best at a small level.
Yes.
And so when they looked at the land masses, they realized that, you know, this was just way too big. Technically, the states are way too big as well. the perfect, when Montesquieu referred to a republic being perfectly done when it is in a small sphere, mm-hmm. that's your county.
Right.
So for us to really have the optimum functioning republic or republican government, it should be, and this is why it is so important that we establish a constitution for our counties, delegating power, and then frame the state constitution, this national league of counties, mm-hmm. general powers, which would then this league of states had framed a, you know, limited and general powers to the national government, or I should say the federal government.
Sure.
So okay. my point is that, you know, he's just looking at the large to the independent states. I honestly believe that the true independence really comes at the county level.
Well, imagine this, you know, I believe the entire population of, let me check something. The entire population of the U.S. at its founding was probably less than what's in the state of Missouri.
I believe it was around 6 million.
Okay, that is the population of Missouri.
Yeah.
And so the point is, at that point, they had individual states for that. We've got 114 counties and an independent city.
Right.
In Missouri.
Right. And okay. They were looking at 6 million people being too much for a republic.
Sure.
And right. So, and that's what I'm saying. If we really put context to the Montesquieu's, you know, optimum republic, it needs to be mm-hmm. at a smaller scale. Then sure. It just starts making sense that, you know, now if we're going to get this right, we got to get it right down at the county level.
Let me share something else that just popped into my head, and that is, you know, when tell me if I get this right. When Moses instituted judges,
50 families.
Right. Okay. In other words, you're correct. That's what I was looking for. You had as center or a population grew, they had a judge assigned. They had more judges because they had more families.
Okay. Yeah, but that would be the first. So that would be like your community.
Sure.
And there was, you know, then there was the next step up, and I don't know how many steps, but it would boil up to the tribe.
Sure.
That, you know, each tribe had a judge, and then if, you know, things passed through that judge, then it would go to the prophet Moses.
Well, the point I wanted to make is they didn't allow for something to become so big that it was like a megalopolis, okay? And so that's the point I'm trying to make, is that as things grow, the representation needs to be proportionally smaller. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Making sense of what I'm saying?
Makes perfect sense.
Okay. All right. Where did I leave off?
Okay. 77. So, yeah, 77. So this is this next paragraph is where Madison uses, you know, that little, you know, defining word. Keep going.
Okay. The same zealots must again say, as they do, with a blank boldness and incongruity, that the government of the United States, which has been so deemed and so called from its birth to the present time, which is organized in the regular forms of representative governments and, like them, operates directly on the individuals represented and whose laws are declared to be the supreme law of the land with a physical force in the government for executing them, is yet no government but a mere agency, a power of attorney revocable at the will of any of the parties granting it.
There you go. So in other words, regardless of all of this power, the federal government still has limited power, that power of attorney has basically afforded the federal government that. And at any point in time, you know, the parties to the compact can revoke those powers.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, the states are in control.
Right.
You know, this, they got this child that is, you know, supposedly moving the union along, and it's all become perverted because it's now, you know, instead of 50-1, it's 1 to subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And correct. That is
not the design.
That is not what is, well, it's correct. I guess that's the better way of saying it. I mean, yeah, it is completely perverted the framework.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's like, you know, a person gets caught. One person gets conquered by a, you know, a company or a small platoon, you know, because a platoon's about 50 men.
Okay.
And so one person gets captured, and it's almost like that one person has the skill of hypnosis that actually convinces these 50 people that he's, you know, he has conquered them. And those 50 absolutely subjugate themselves because they really believe that they've been conquered.
Right.
There's no truth to it. All they have to do is wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And voila. We have the power. They are the subject. We are not.
Correct.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So, we are now at, what are we, 79?
Yep, keep going.
Yes, it may be.
No. It's one before that.
I missed one.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. Strange as it must appear, there are some who maintain these doctrines and hold this language, and what is stranger still, denounce those as heretics and apostates who adhere to the language and tenets of their fathers. And this is done with an exulting question whether every right has not its remedy, and what remedy can be found against federal usurpations other than that of a right in every state to nullify and resist the federal acts at its pleasure. Yes, 79. Yes, it may be safely admitted that every right has its remedy, as it must be admitted that the remedy under the Constitution lies where it has been marked out by the Constitution, and that no appeal can be consistently made from that remedy by those who were and still profess to be parties to it, but the appeal to the parties themselves having an authority above the Constitution or to the laws of nature and of nature's God.
There you go. And so I just have to say that from as it must be admitted to the end of this paragraph, that really needs to be highlighted. And, I mean, if you really look at what he's saying, there's nothing but the appeal to the parties themselves. That's the only remedy, that you have to appeal to the parties themselves having an authority above the Constitution or to the laws of nature and nature's God.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
AD. It is painful to be obliged to notice such a sophism as that by which this inference is assailed. Because an unconstitutional law is no law, it is alleged that it may be constitutionally disobeyed by all who think it unconstitutional. The fallacy is so obvious that it can impose on none but the most biased and heedless observers. I got to stop there for a minute. Just because he makes a point that I think those who would support single state nullification would not disagree with him. He said, because an unconstitutional law is no law.
Right.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so because that particular line, you know, I can see the nullifiers latching onto that, said, you're right, it's no law. So here's the question. Why do they need to obey
right
a law?
Well, keep going. He's going to answer that. Keep going.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
The fallacy is so obvious. The fallacy is
so obvious that it can impose none but the most biased and heedless observers. It makes no distinction where the distinction is obvious, and essentially between the case of a law confessedly unconstitutional and a case turning on a doubt and a divided opinion as to the meaning of the Constitution, on a question not whether the Constitution ought or ought not to be obeyed, but on the question, what is the Constitution? And can it be seriously and deliberately maintained that every individual or every subordinate authority or every party to a compact has a right to take for granted that its construction is the infallible one and to act upon it against the construction of all others, having an equal right to expound the instrument, nay, against the regular exposition of the constituted authorities with the tacit sanction of the community? Such a doctrine must be seen at once to be subversive to all constitutions, all laws, and all compacts. The provision made by a constitution for its own exposition through its own authorities and forms must prevail whilst the constitution is left to itself by those who made it, or until cases arise which justify a resort to ultra-constitutional interpositions. So, what I think he's saying here is what he said before. In other words, if you think it's, if this state thinks it's unconstitutional for this reason, or this state thinks it's unconstitutional for that reason, or this community thinks it's unconstitutional, you've got chaos. Okay?
Yep.
Because everyone's going their own way. What they need to do is the parents, let me just share with you, okay? It's like being a parent. Okay, a kid can play one parent against the other, right?
Yep.
Okay, I've seen it. I've had five kids. I know how that works. Unless the parents are communicating with each other, they may not know what's going on. And once they come to an agreement on how to manage the situation, then the kid gets the proper behavior.
Yeah, yeah, but he ends this with what becomes the obvious action when you have circumstances that just cannot be permitted to persist. In other words, you can't allow this problem to persist. Then what do you do? The last three words.
Ultra-constitutional interpositions.
There you go. In other words, you know, such a vigorous act of interposition to obtain compliance.
Okay. Wow. We should probably spend a little time on that one when we come back tomorrow.
So, at good points, because we've ran out of time. So, good eye. You actually saw that one coming. Anyway, folks, as you can tell, I mean, this Madison takes this to ad nauseum, but he really points out that the states are obligated. We have to do this. We have to hold the government accountable. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.